I'm Mindy.
And I'm Darren.
I'm Sean.
And we are the Rants Macabre, a part of the Fangoria Podcast Network. For more information about the network, including other programs, how to follow the show, and find past episodes of the Rants Macabre, please visit fangoria.com.
So, Sean, Spooky Sean Thompson from Miskatonic Musings. Yay. And
yes, that is my name.
Digital overseer of Word Horde. What is social media?
I call myself social media manager. Some people have described me as the head of PR, which is wholly irresponsible because I know nothing of anything except Facebook and Twitter. So,
okay, but still resume line all the same.
Yeah, exactly.
You'll take it.
I'll take it. Yeah. I mean, I feel like that's not what I do because it ascribes more to me, but I'll take it.
Yeah. Why not?
Okay. Well, you're joining us because you are publishing your first flash. What is the term for this collection?
The term is a chapbook, which refers to a book that is short, around 30 pages. The easiest way would be to consider it a short collection.
Okay.
A short story collection.
All right. Okay.
So this will be available by the time the podcast comes out. Fingers crossed.
Ideally.
So we'll also cover it at the back end, but why don't you tell people where they can find you online?
Okay. Well, you can find me at Spooky Sean T. That's the Twitter handle. Facebook.com/SpookySean is the official page. And with the book, I'm planning on having it available for the Kindle, so on Amazon as an ebook, and I'm going to be doing create space for physical copies.
Oh, cool. Cool.
But I'll be linking to it on my Twitter and on my Facebook, and I'll be sure to let you guys know too, so you can help me plug it too. But of course, what is this if not helping me plug it?
Yeah. And we'll have it in the show notes as well. Cool. So yeah, for this episode, you didn't want to talk exclusively about the book and the short stories.
I didn't want to talk exclusively about the collection because here's the thing. I understand, listener, you might know me from Miskatonic Musings, but you don't know me as an author. Just flat out, you don't. And so to talk about the collection, especially when it's not already out, it seems kind of dickish. Like, hey, I'm so great. You know, all my stories, they're so good. You know, there's no proof to back this up, but they are. And then we'll just schmooze about how great I am and like, oh, I love that story that you're not going to be able to read for a while. But I'd rather talk about something that you can actually go out and watch right after you listen to this if you want to. Something that's easily accessible and things that have influenced me a lot in terms of my creative output.
And right. On that note, you chose three pilot episodes of shows.
I did. I thought it'd be interesting to talk about three pilots of television shows, especially when I'm coming out with what is ostensibly my like short story collection kind of pilot type of thing. It's very similar. You know, you're throwing yourself out there. You're like, hey, I hope people like this so I can keep going with stuff. Which, of course, that being said, there are plenty of failed pilots and the creators and actors go on to do better things. But yeah. I liked the idea of covering, you know, the firsts. And these three pilots are three of my favorites, so I figured, why the fuck not?
Yeah, these are three kind of millennial less so, but like seminal episodes that Tales from the Crypt specifically,
yeah.
I grew up with HBO as kind of our babysitter growing up, and so Tales from the Crypt at an inappropriately young age did a lot to sort of shape my sensibility.
And there was even the Saturday morning cartoon, Tales from the Crypt Keeper. Yeah, in the 90s, that was a thing.
That completely got by me.
I had it on VHS, well, because we recorded it off of TV, and I pretended like it was new every time I watched it, as you do.
Sean, did you know there was a cartoon?
I did know there was a cartoon. Yes, I watched it sometimes.
Because what's great about Tales from the Crypt is that each one, it's like a creepy Aesop's Fable.
Right.
Well, Aesop's Fable are pretty creepy anyway, but it's like everything's a morality tale, so why not show it to kids?
Yeah, it's in my notes that when it's best, Tales from the Crypt is like a really gruesome episode of The Twilight Zone.
Yes.
Yeah, definitely. But you learn like a lesson. Everyone learns a lesson.
Yeah, and
it's like an episode of The Twilight Zone with swears and boobs.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There were a lot of boobs. I was surprised.
Kids love bad puns.
Yes.
Kids love a pun.
Bad, and bad puns. Yes. So of course, when I saw this at what 11 or it was 11 or 12, I can't remember exact age, but it had an effect.
A cool effect, sure.
Okay, so we'll be starting off with Tales from the Crypt, which has its own like YouTube channel, thankfully, because otherwise it's hard to come by. It's not on HBO Go.
No.
It is available on DVD, but that'd be kind of a dick move to make you go out and buy a DVD. But listeners, if you want to, the seasons are available on DVD.
There you
unless
go.
They unless they stop making them, then I'm sorry, then redact that.
The first episode was directed by Walter Hill, and I wouldn't have guessed because Walter Hill is like one and the same who made The Warriors, 48 Hours, another 48 Hours. He produced a bunch of the Alien franchise. He also writes a bunch of his own stuff. And I guess he co-wrote this episode, right?
I had no idea. Well, I mean, yeah, Walter Hill is credited, yeah. But I had no idea he had done The Warriors.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess I just blanked on that.
He's like action movie royalty. And I noticed that he directed three different episodes of Tales from the Crypt over the years. And one of them, the second one, is one of my all-time favorites, Cutting Cards with Lance Henriksen.
Oh, yeah.
The
one where they take off limbs when they...
Yeah, well, it's the story of two gamblers that it gets more and more excessive and it becomes like a fear factor, like ultimate gore annihilation thing where it just, they keep upping the stakes and it gets really gruesome. But it is like just black comedy done perfectly.
Now
really
I'm
going
to have to watch this YouTube channel and watch them all again.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But yeah, so my memory of the Crypt Keeper was, I guess, like the later seasons where he's... you know, you get the full opening. This episode really just starts you out in the basement.
Yeah, you don't do the full track.
The same way the X-Files didn't have a proper opening sequence until a couple episodes in.
I believe that's because it was, you know, early on. And especially with the pilot, I think at that point they're not sure if it's going to get picked up. So they figure, why bother spending the money on an intro?
Definitely.
Yeah, and if memory serves, there's very little footage of them as agents. But I think the footage they use is from, like, episode number two. So they needed something to put into the opening credits.
Right. But, yeah, no, you don't get the whole track scene in this opening for Tales.
Yeah, starting outside of the house and going into the crypt. And I got to say, the Crypt Keeper's, like, pun joke... success ratio is pretty low. He wasn't as funny as I remember him.
He was less cartoony than he became.
Right, right.
So it's funny. He's actually played a little straighter, you know? He's like more of a... He's less fun-loving, I guess, and more... Like, his voice is even kind of different.
Ah, poor little fellas. When I think of their childhood... All those cute little maggots. Our story is about a man with nobler ambitions. He likes to kill human pests, and he does it in front of an audience. Now that's entertainment!
The Crypt Keeper, I wish I had the actor's name in front of me because he won't be in the M. Night Shyamalan reboot of Tales from the Crypt because I guess...
I completely forgot they're actually remaking this.
Yeah, that's supposed to come out. Is that coming out this year?
I don't know. I think M. Night Shyamalan's still like occupied with Wayward Pines.
Which I thought was canceled. I'm always surprised every time someone brings it up that it's still like a TV show.
Yeah.
It's still going, yeah. That's like Bones. I'm like, is that still on?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It just dies away slowly.
NCIS? Like, who is watching these shows? People turn on the TV and walk out of the room. Like, all over the country, there's just lonely televisions.
Playing NCIS. Wayward Pines.
But yes, Tales from the Crypt. So the first episode is pretty much what I remember. I mean, frankly, I haven't watched these since I was a kid.
This here is Charlie Ledbetter, sitting in his cell out the state penitentiary. It's long about midnight. Charlie's gonna die in a few minutes. One thing Mr. Ledbetter ain't thinking about is Joe Saylor, his old boss. You see, one day Charlie had a half pint of vodka for lunch. He got to thinking about how they turned him down when he wanted that raise. Now, he felt real bad about that, old Charlie did. He'd been working there for about 7 years, and he didn't have too much to show for it. So he went down and got his cold blue .44 out of the glove box of his Chevy, took it up to Mr. Saylor's office. Two slugs went into Sailor. Three went wild. Last one went right through a glass wall into a secretary that's passing by. Got it right behind the ear. Killed it big as hell. Kind of a lucky shot, really. About the only kind of luck Charlie Ledbetter ever had.
William Sadler plays our narrator protagonist once mm-hmm. we're into the story. And he is an executioner at a prison. His specialty is the electric chair. And, you know, the old saying, like, if you love your job, you never work a day in your life.
Right. He loves this shit.
He loves to electrocute people.
Like, he is so gleeful about it.
I guess right about now, Charlie Ledbetter's starting to think pretty serious about that Valley of Death. He's thinking about that rubber diaper they give him to wear. Wondering if he's going to crap all over himself when I juice him in a couple minutes. He will.
It's really creepy. And it's funny that, like, historically, the hangman, the executioner, like, these guys wear hoods so as to maintain anonymity.
Mm-hmm.
But he talks about really vividly, like,
he
looking
really
in
the... He really likes it. He likes looking in their eyes. He says that specifically.
Yeah, he's a fucking creep. But I did like... William Sadler is not... I mean, we've seen him a bunch. He's a character actor mm-hmm. who pops up in everything from, like, Die Hard 2 to mm-hmm. The Mist.
Shawshank.
Right, yeah. He was. Mm-hmm. We saw that he was in Shawshank and Green Mile, so he's a Frank Darabont guy. But he very rarely gets, you know, top billing.
Right.
And I really liked him in this.
Well, he's a real, like, he's the real deal kind of an actor. He's got a master's in acting from Cornell.
Oh.
I mean, he's legit. He also, he has a minor. And see, we were talking about the accent that he uses, which is an Oklahoma accent, but like a really deep one. And we're like, oh, and you said, oh, he must be from there. But he's actually not. He's from like upstate New York or something.
Acting.
And he's actually, like, accents are his specialty. That's his thing. And so he has a minor in speech something. So he's a huge accent guy.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's funny that it took like a horror property to give him top billing to put him in the front because otherwise.
Well, he was Julius Caesar when. Do you remember when Denzel Washington was doing
Othello? No.
Julius Caesar. He was doing Julius Caesar. He was in that. And William Sadler was Julius Caesar in that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, he's like the real deal actor.
Yeah, cool.
Which is funny because if you don't see him in Tales from the Crypto, he's a bit player.
Right, exactly. In film, it's not really his thing.
So, Sean, what was it about this episode that stayed with you? Would you call it formative?
I would call it formative. I think what really stayed with me is that there's a really strong connection you get from the very beginning with all the fourth wall breaking where he's talking. It's not like other shows where they're obviously talking to you, but they're... You know, they try to pretend like it's this real universe and they're actually, you know, living their lives and you just happen to be, you get a window into that. This is just, he's breaking the fourth wall, staring right through the TV, talking to you the entire episode as he's planning all of this shit. Like, oh, I'm going to kill this guy.
Yeah.
I think he deserves to die as he just stares at you.
Yeah.
And it's really, I'm a big fan of breaking the fourth wall. I like when a character just talks to you. I find it very unnerving because it's not always done.
They say electric current's so fast the brain gets cooked just as soon as the switch is thawed. Prisoner never feels a thing. Boy, I'd hate to think that was true.
Yeah, I was going to ask you how much there are elements of this in the very first short story, Fickle Mortality, in terms of the narrator speaking to the reader directly, mm-hmm. and in this case they sort of share a setting. Was this in mind when you were writing?
It wasn't specifically in mind. Initially, all I wanted to do was write a story about a female serial killer on death row because I didn't think there were enough stories about female serial killers. And I mean, traditionally, there are not as many female serial killers at least that are caught. Maybe they're better at it.
Yeah. Well, right. The standard profile is like white male between the ages of 6 and 40. Like it's always like a very generic. It's like
the 6-year-old serial killer.
Yeah. I think the mental picture they paint of every serial killer is essentially Jeffrey Dahmer.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And even when we go in to talk about Millennium, Frank says something about that in Millennium, too.
Yeah,
about,
yeah, about he discounts a suspect.
When he was, yeah, but then I looked it up, and there actually are a lot of black male serial killers, so, ha.
So there.
So there, Frank. Equal opportunity killing.
It wasn't directly in mind, like, you know, Fickle Mortality and this episode, but definitely having seen this episode, I think the seed of that idea was, like, somewhere in the back of my mind while I was writing it, to the point where, having seen this episode, I'm like, oh, I'm totally doing that, aren't I? But I wasn't even cognizant of it.
Yeah. And making it a woman, I guess, after reading it, then thinking back to it, I felt like there was a little bit of holding back the point that it was a woman telling the story. And that's a little bit of an unexpected turn, because, you know, when it comes to anybody confessing murder, like we were just saying, there is a type, and mm-hmm. women are generally not the type.
I didn't want to overemphasize it. Anytime I write as a woman, or, you know, a gay character or a person of color, I never want to overemphasize it, because it feels cheap somehow. Yeah. It feels like you're trying to sell the story that way, and that's not what I'm doing. All of my characters are essentially the same. It's just if they're of a different, you know, gender, sexuality, skin color, I might throw a couple of nods in there, but by and large, they're all... I try to treat every character as if they'd have the same kind of reactions,
mm-hmm.
more or less, because I feel like they're all essentially, you know, they're all coming from my head. So they are kind of going to be a similar style of character. I don't want to have a particular vernacular, for instance, if I'm writing as a black character. I might, but I try not to emphasize it.
Well, I don't think, like, most people don't think about their gender as a separate thought. Like, mm-hmm. enough so to address it. So it would be conspicuous.
Like, well, if you were to hop into, like, my head, for instance, I wouldn't be like, oh, I'm a man doing manly things.
Right.
Right.
Look at me doing my manly things out and about. No, I'd just be like, oh, I gotta go get some milk.
I don't remember William Sadler's character's name, but...
Niles Talbot.
Niles Talbot?
Yeah.
That's... Wow. All right, that's literary.
Fancy.
Yeah. Well, Talbot, that's... Almost, it's probably not, but like a reference to the original Wolfman.
Maybe.
I think Larry Talbot is the, it could be. It's Tales from the Crypt, I'm sure.
And Niles is from Frasier.
Well, I was thinking his character's obsession with his job and being the sort of last line in the justice process, so to speak, I couldn't think of an example before this, the idea that someone, because the idea of, like, executioner, we mentioned before that, like, it's a position, it's an anonymous person where you're kind of supposed to respect that, like, this is a really ugly thing that this country does, but you know, if you're a true believer, then you believe it's necessary, but you're not supposed to like it.
My name's Niles Talbot. I've been the executioner in this state for the last 12 years. When I got here from Oklahoma, I caught on as an electrician, and after a while, I got a job out to the prison, taking care of the generators. I like electricity. It's dependable. You can trust it. Let's say do it with gas or with some lethal injection. I don't take to that. That's how you kill a dog or a cat or something, not a man.
No, and you're not supposed to visibly like it either. You're not supposed to be gleeful about it.
Yeah, right. And that's
it's
why
your job, and it's something you have to do.
Yeah, and that he enjoys it so much that, like, he makes it a pastime is really, really fucked up and, like, disturbed.
Well, I also love the overlapping narratives as well. From the beginning of the episode, you get him talking about this guy who's on death row because he got fired. And he killed his boss, right? Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Niles gets fired because they don't want to have the death penalty anymore in the state. And he doesn't kill his boss, but he's killing what he deems to be people that deserve to die, criminals that should be given the death penalty. So you get that overlap where he's actually not that far off from the guy he killed in the beginning of the episode. I think the closing thought I had on just Tales from the Crypt in general, but especially the pilot, is I love the juxtaposition of being really campy and hokey, you know, like with the Crypt Keeper, but then also going dark as fuck with it, where it's like a guy getting electrocuted and electrocuting other, like an electrocutioner who's getting electrocuted and just showing it.
Yeah, I remember the sense of humor specifically, and as a little kid, like it didn't take much to make me laugh, and so the parade of bad puns and just mm-hmm. the Crypt Keeper, the minute he stops being creepy, you can laugh at it.
Yeah, yeah.
And down the line, I don't know, I like the dark sense of humor associated with the show, but like Sean said, there are episodes down the line that the episodes are not interested in comedy at times if it doesn't, you know, suit the narrative. There was a great one where an artist, like he's meant to be kind of an avant-garde painter, who starts using human blood in his painting.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the episodes I was thinking in terms of the Twilight Zone reference. Sean, do you remember the painter who winds up killing a guy in a parking lot for his blood and he paints it on like a broken box side?
I don't remember it off the top of my head, but like I said, I'm sure it's in there somewhere. I'm sure it's cataloged somewhere back there.
I think it's in one of the later seasons, but that was one that it ended and just like it really, it was a fucking gut punch and it really just left you uncomfortable. And it's hilarious that it always had to end with the Crypt Keeper. So like,
and then he's just like, oh, that's, I don't know, you'd make a terrible pun about art, you know?
Yeah.
Like, so it's like, it's almost like the whole thing is a big joke.
Yeah.
Which is even worse because it's like, I just watched a man kill people and you're just laughing about it and making bad puns.
Yeah.
Like, is mortality really worthy of bad puns?
I'm thinking the way the nightly news, like, they're actually pretty good at leaving you off on like a note of you know, like, this is a kid who's hearing for the first time after
that's true, right. Though, yeah.
Implant or whatever. So they do like to sort of course correct. So, you know, the show actually did have its viewers in mind, I'm going to say.
Yeah. I wonder what their like main demographic was, though. Like when they sold this show, they said the following people will be into the show.
Probably like 18 to 30.
Do you think that old 18? You wouldn't think like 12 to...
Well, it's on
boobs,
HBO, and
that's
it's
true.
Full of boobs. I mean, like, that's what they would tell people the audience was. I think secretly it's probably more like 15 to 30. Yeah.
I wonder if anybody in that crew had the balls to say, this is going to go over so well, I'm telling you, fucking gangbusters, we're going to make a cartoon of this.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just like, oh, bullshit, it'll never happen.
Because there were tons, and there was New Tales as well. Which I think was another. And then.
Was that also a cartoon?
It was a Saturday morning show, I think. And then, then ABC or whatever said cartoons need to have more merit for kids.
Okay.
This was like a thing that happened in the 90s. And so then it was no more. You learn lots of lessons.
That's the same thing that happened to the original Tales from the Crypt comics.
Yeah, that you see.
Yeah, they have to have merit. Like the villain has to be punished. There were all these rules that came into play.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to bring up, though, is it's not that far-fetched because it started as a comic that, let's face it, comic books back in the 50s were made for children. They weren't made for anybody except children. So it was pretty ballsy to just be like, yeah, here's some horrible shit. Have at kids.
Yeah, read this.
Before they started paying real close attention for like what kids were reading.
Right.
And all of a sudden it was about saving the children. But
in this story, actually, it came from the Crypt of Terror. EC comic.
Okay.
Number 17. Watch out.
It's been on my to-do list to track down because they've put together a bunch of volumes mm-hmm. of the Tales from the Crypt and you can get them through Comixology. But even when we were doing the Grand Guignol episode, so it's on my to-do list, but horror comics from the 50s actually really hold a fascination for me. But yeah, okay, let's jump into the X-Files. This I'm excited to talk about. Premiering in 1993, did you guys watch it from the start? I did not.
I did.
Yeah?
It was on Friday nights on Fox.
Yeah, I did. I remember when it was Friday nights.
Mm-hmm.
That's bold. And where you get your nickname, Sean? Spooky?
It's where I really ham-fistedly stole my nickname from. Saying I got the nickname is pretty... presumptuous. I basically was just like, what would be a good domain name that incorporates my name that would be easy to remember? And I think I was just driving with my girlfriend. I said, Spooky Sean. And I was like, oh, that's so stupid. But then I thought about it, and I was like, God, it's really easy to remember, though. And it's got like the Mulder nod. And I think, I'm not proud of it, but I think there's a little bit of a nod to Slim Shady in there, too, just in terms of the like sibilance. Like many things in my life, it was not intentional.
Oh, the Slim Shady.
Yeah, yeah.
So the baby of Chris Carter, although he didn't direct the very first episode, I guess he didn't quite have the juice yet.
Yeah.
So the very first episode is written by Chris Carter, directed by Robert Mandel, who directed the movie FX.
Yeah, FX.
And School Ties and a whole lot of television.
The Substitute as well.
Oh, yeah.
I've never seen that one. That's a treat.
And yeah, so we mentioned before that there are no opening titles. It's just like a logo and a little bit of smoke. It's before Mark Snow arrived at the theme. But I thought it was really... I didn't think it was necessary to say it was inspired by true events.
You know, when that came up, I just watched the entire series maybe a year ago, and it was a huge like undertaking. And I apparently forgot about that, because then when I went to rewatch it for this show, I was like, is this really inspired by true events? Like, what's happening? I don't remember that at all.
I forgot, too, because they stopped trying to do that.
I forgot that was a thing.
Yeah, I don't know if you look up the details, if there were people who claimed to be abducted and had marks. That's the closest I can think.
Well, the thing about the show that was great was in its heyday, they had all sorts of people they paid to do research.
Oh.
Yeah. So it would be like a couple people doing research for the specific episodes. That's why they sound so smart when they're talking.
And then Chris Carter said no more of that.
And then Chris Carter gave up and was like, you know what would be great if we ever did a new season is have Mulder take mushrooms and, you know, just in general have this like real Republican-y, douchebaggy kind of vibe.
Totally.
For people completely confused, when they brought the X-Files back this year into what amounted to a garbage fire.
One good episode.
There was one good episode.
There was one, yeah.
Yeah.
Of course, this, if anyone had seen that second movie that came out, you knew how it was going to be.
Yeah, terrible. I didn't. I
thought it would be, I don't know, and I was still waiting for like a Doggett and...
Reyes.
Yeah, a Doggett and Reyes thing.
Well, right, she pops up once in the new episode.
Yeah, Doggett wasn't even there.
But she's not using her psychic dreaming powers.
So stupid.
But what was I going to say? The new episodes...
Sorry, I got distracted by Doggett and Reyes.
The newer of the two movies, if memory serves, it was about like an accused child molester in Alaska. And it's not anything that one would associate with the X-Files, but for some reason, like Mulder gets special dispensation to like come back and work for the FBI. Like,
I'm laughing because remember when we had this conversation at lunch and I was describing this movie to you that didn't happen.
Right. No. You were describing the first movie.
I described for like a whole hour, Sean.
Yeah.
The plot of the first movie and act like it was the second. I just put like Billy Connolly in
there
for some reason.
I humored you for a while. Yeah. I was watching you figure it out.
It was like a whole hour. It was so stupid.
The funny thing about the second movie is if you actually took out Mulder and Scully, it would be a far better movie. Like if you took out that framing device, if you just had Billy Connolly, like he actually wasn't bad.
Billy Connolly's good.
He's a great actor.
Yeah.
Yeah. That I wonder if that
so
was.
If it was just a film about Billy Connolly as a child molester who has psychic powers or may or may not have psychic powers, and then it's like just other FBI agents, like that'd be a pretty solid flick, I think.
Yeah, that's a terrifying thought. That's a terrifying like.
Now I'm
super villain.
I'm imagining, yeah, like a villain who gets these powers upon molesting children. And he's like, I don't even like kids. I'm just really addicted to this psychic ability.
I wanted to take it. I thought I was going to say he's just psychic and happens to be a child molester, not he's psychic because of being a child molester.
I didn't think that either, Darren.
That's particularly
I was with Sean.
Awful, but like, no, I mean, that's God. then I'd have that serious like doubts about the rewrites, you know, like maybe we should do it. Like, it is pretty devastating. It would open up some weird psychic floodgates.
That's crazy.
I wonder if it was a movie project that they just kind of slotted Mulder and Scully into.
From what I've gathered, it was a case of like, okay, you have the money, but you have to do it like in this really short time span. So go, 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 or else you're not going to get it.
That makes sense. Hmm. That seems about right.
Like it plays like a solid middle season episode.
I guess the first character, well, after the abduction scene, we get the first time to see Scully in the world's biggest blazer.
So big.
Yeah. The shoulder pads, like, I mean, it's an ongoing joke for like 90s wardrobe, but holy shit. Like,
yeah, and it went to almost her knees too.
It was really
giant jacket. Like she stole it from someone before she came in.
Yeah, that was a weird wardrobe choice.
I don't know why. Clearly the hair is definitely like a Jodie Foster.
I mean, if they were going for like, this is a government agent who doesn't care about being fashionable, then it works.
Yeah, I guess. She doesn't seem to really care.
I don't think in 1993 she would have stood out that much. I think it was just kind of par for the course.
Fashion was terrible back then, as you well know.
Yeah.
Yeah, no.
But yeah, no, I think they were going for a Silence of the Lambs.
They
Jodie
definitely
Foster
with the
thing.
Hair. And then later they were like, no, give her bangs. And then they did. They gave her little bangs for a while.
Carter originally wanted to cast Jodie Foster.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That seems about right.
Oh, okay. The setup of her character, I talk about it later in my notes about Millennium, but Millennium being a show that it is exclusively like middle-aged and older actors. And so when they start talking about, you know, the job, like just using lingo and whatnot, it is very much like a weathered world. Like these are guys with life experience. And it sort of flies in the face of modern programming where it's just like we have a bunch of sexy people. They happen to be fighting crime.
Right.
But in this case, this is actually one of the first times that we saw a really young actress inheriting this role that is like uber complex. They, you know, very quickly do the exposition that explains she's a medical doctor.
We see you've been with us just over 2 years.
Yes, sir.
You went to medical school, but you chose not to practice. How'd you come to work for the FBI?
Well, sir, I was recruited out of medical school. My parents still think it was an act of rebellion, but I saw the FBI as a place where I could distinguish myself.
She's like 25 years old.
Yeah, she's done a lot for being 25 years old in this, getting recruited out of medical school.
And I guess even, well, it comes later, but Mulder, like, she wrote a thesis on, like, physics? Like, it's just
some Einstein.
What can't she do? Dress herself, apparently, is the only thing she can.
She's so busy.
She's too busy writing papers about Einstein's theory of relativity. I don't know what she wrote about.
It was some Einstein thing. I can't remember, though.
Yeah. Some Einstein-y smart shit.
Yeah. I have a degree in opera, so I don't know. Words.
Einstein's twin paradox, a new interpretation. Dana Scully's senior thesis. Now that's a credential, rewriting Einstein.
Did you bother to read it?
I did. I liked it. It's just that in most of my work, laws of physics rarely seem to apply.
But yeah, so in that office, we are introduced to a director, but we get the cigarette-smoking man, the first appearance of him, and my understanding was that he was almost...
He wanted
just like
to be
a
the director
piece.
Originally. So he auditioned for the guy who got all the three lines.
Oh.
And then he didn't get it. He got to be Smoking Man, which then later became the biggest part of the show.
Right. And I guess he's supposed to be just an ominous figure, you know, sort of a man without a name. But I guess they loved him on camera just foreboding. Back in the days when you could fucking smoke in a government building. How do you like that?
But even when you couldn't, he's still doing it. Even
when
the show
in Skinner's office.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but I guess Skinner doesn't get introduced until a couple episodes in. In that sit-down meeting, they very quickly ask her her familiarity with Spooky Mulder.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of love that he is almost like an urban legend amongst cadets.
Are you familiar with an agent named Fox Mulder?
Yes, I am.
How so?
By reputation.
He's an Oxford-educated psychologist who wrote a monograph on the serial killer Monty Props.
That's right, in 1988.
Generally thought of as the best analyst in the violent crime section. He had a nickname at the academy. Spooky Mulder.
Sean wasn't even reading when he said that just now. That was off the dome.
No, but then I'm thinking, like, good thing it was him that they came to talk to her about, because, like, does she know every single thing about every single person?
And yeah, does she know? And it's like, oh, Darren. Well, Darren was a Harvard-educated psychologist whose nickname was Droopy Darren.
Wait, what did they call you on Miskatonics?
Darlin. Darlin.
Darlin' Darren. No, but then he knows the same thing. So then I'm thinking, is this some FBI like thing?
The way I interpreted it was Agent Mulder had made such a spectacle of himself that you couldn't help but know who he was. Like, he was like the weird guy in the office where you're like, oh, who's that guy? Don't talk too loud around him.
Is that us, Darren? We're those people in the office.
What I'll also tell you is that Agent Mulder has developed a consuming devotion to an unassigned project outside the Bureau mainstream. Are you familiar with the so-called X-Files?
I believe they have to do with unexplained phenomena.
More or less. The reason you're here, Agent Scully, is we want you to assist Mulder on these X-Files. You will write field reports on your activities, along with your observations on the validity of the work.
Am I to understand that you want me to debunk the X-Files project, sir?
I mean, let's be real about this. This was a guy who was at the top of his game, who was like, okay, guys, I'm going to move to the basement and hunt aliens.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, this was a, like, legitimately educated man with, like, multiple degrees who was, like, the best profiler that they had, who one day was like, I'm going to research into aliens.
I think that's kind of cool. Robbie Williams did that for a while. He kind of went on a bender.
Yeah, but right. He did it on account of, like, smoking meth.
Yeah, probably. Like,
but he was not a Harvard
Mulder just found educated aliens.
Or where was he?
No.
Oxford. He wasn't an Oxford-educated psychologist.
No, Robbie Williams might have strolled. What? He was in Take That. Yeah, but you know what? They never really play up the idea that Mulder kind of lost his mind and wound up in the basement. They just kind of take it as like, well, it happens to some people. They wash out and wind up in the basement.
Well, they seem to let him do whatever he wants, though.
He talks about having like the senatorial connections that protect him.
He does, and he does throughout the first season, then he doesn't anymore.
He definitely comes off as like a very douchey person. And there's got to be a reason he's able to be so douchey. And A, it's got to be because he's a genius.
Right.
And B, it's got to be because he has connections. It's either one of the two. And if you have both, it explains why he's such a douche for no reason.
And they just let him do whatever he wants.
It's funny. I don't think of him ever as a douche. Maybe just, I don't know. I liked him very quickly.
Well, because you're rooting for him. But like, if you look at him from like anyone else's eyes, he's at a like cemetery and he's just like, whatever, dude.
Well, that answers a question that we had. Why you hadn't done the recent autopsy on Karen Swenson? You're aware of the tissue sample that was taken from the girl's body.
What is the insinuation here? Are you saying that I missed something in those other kids' exams?
We're not insinuating anything, sir.
Yeah, this show really light on procedure. I was probably one of the early cases of like, we're just going to tell the story, and if it happens to jive with official procedure, then so be it, but it's not
what I really like is I definitely read an article at one point that described all of the times they would have been fired, and it was pretty it started pretty early.
That is one thing.
I mean, like, they can't justify any of the money they spend most of the time.
No, they just, and they wreck everything. Very similar to Ripley is just like wrecking shit all the time and costing this company gazillions of dollars.
Yeah.
But this is the one thing. I love X-Files. And like I said, I just watched all of them about a year ago. But that universe, that show is not made to be binge watched because that universe is a goddamn mess.
Yeah.
It's a real mess.
It really speaks of a time before Netflix, before a lot of widespread home video.
Where you thought people would forget.
Where you would have to watch it on TV.
Yeah.
And that would be the only memory you'd have. Because, yes, right. When you go, like, I remember it being the most epic thing on TV, and it was, because it really played to the fact that there was going to be like 4 months in between, you know, right. with the finale and the next episode. But if you watch them back to back, yeah, it doesn't exactly.
The universe mesh is as well. Not good. It's not very congruent at all.
Yeah.
And I'm used to something like Joss Whedon's universes, which make complete sense. You know, yeah, like,
well, he writes the arcs.
Yeah.
At the beginning.
He can do crossovers and still not fuck up his universe. But like, they all forget that Scully can't be killed by the end of this show. And that like John Doggett's been switched with alternate John Doggett and Rhea. It's like very confusing.
I love that the very, very last, spoiler alert, very, very last episode of The X-Files. And please don't listen to this if you know, cover your ears if you're actually planning to watch the full season of The X-Files or every season you haven't. There is an hour-long explanation from Agent Mulder of season to season what actually happened, and it's the most batshit insane thing I've ever heard.
That last, before this last season that just happened,
yeah.
But that last two episodes of the show.
The court.
God
episode,
damn. Yeah, it gets so.
It was like
bad.
This. It was like the series finale of Seinfeld in terms yeah. of like dragging in all these story points that they've.
Yeah,
left.
And Skinner's like, and then this happened. And you're like, Skinner, are you even listening to yourself right now?
Yeah, I thought more concise was the Musings of a Cigarette Smoking Man, which kind of lays it out and you know spells it out in case you didn't see every episode.
I was interested in aliens anyway, and I had met a guy when I was vacationing. Who was a psychologist, and he said he had been given something, and he actually gave it to me later on because I needed it to show it to Fox. It was called the Roper Survey, and it was a scientific survey that showed that 9% of America believes in aliens and extraterrestrials, and something like 4% or 3% believe they'd actually been abducted. So I thought, that is so great, a built-in audience. And lo and behold, people were interested in aliens, and I was interested in them not necessarily for their alien quality, but I was interested in them because it was really a great entry into the supernatural and the unknown. And I wanted to tell a lot of stories, different stories, and I didn't want to tell just alien stories, but I knew that would be the core and ultimately the mythology that we pursued. The way we actually dealt with the mythology on the show actually came about by chance. If you look at the first two episodes of The X-Files, which is The Pilot and Deep Throat, they really are the first two mythology episodes. There was a story, EBE, in the first season that could be considered a mythology episode, but it skirted the mythology a little bit. The show that ended the first season, which was Erlenmeyer Flask, was another a rock that we built this giant pile on.
Yeah, no, I was thinking back to the sort of expense of the X-Files.
We're flying to a different fucking state, like, every episode.
And their closure rate is abysmal.
They
the number
never.
Of cases they actually solve is like maybe 5%.
And that's where the Kolchak, the Night Stalker influence is the strongest. Because if you've ever watched the Kolchak series. He does all this research and chases all these monsters and ghoulies. But have you ever thought, like, what was the article he actually wrote? Because, like, he never tied anything up. So it would be this bullshitty kind of, like, meandering, like, oh, and they got away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kolchak, you think he'd be fired by this? You know what I'm saying?
He would have been fired after, like, the second episode. Because he's also going off and doing these weird monster stories when he's supposed to be doing, like, fucking mediocre normal newspaper shit.
Yeah, sometimes they'll end the episode with his, like, final words of the article. But it amounts to like, sorry I couldn't have a more definitive answer to this weird monster
also,
question.
I don't even know that he gets to publish those articles most of the time.
That's fair.
Also what I wondered is like, who, if, yeah, he's writing these articles, but are they actually going to print? No.
He might only have like two articles of the whole like 12 or 13 episodes that actually get published.
Yeah.
And, in like a year span.
I think even Duchovny and Gillian Anderson have talked about, like, no, they are the worst agents on the entire
FBI.
They
really are.
Like, they are not accountable for any solutions for closing any cases. Like, it's the most unrealistic thing about the show, including the aliens.
Things like, well, maybe this is how it is in the FBI, and you just get to do whatever. Because I thought, for a while, I thought being in the FBI would have been a really cool job. I would have loved to have done that.
No kidding. My high school, you know, decision-making time, what are you going to do with the rest of your life? I was either going to go to art school, or I was thinking law enforcement on track to go to the FBI. Not thinking I was going to wind up in a basement chasing aliens.
See, but I did. That's what I would want to do. Because I told you, if I didn't have to have a real job that I needed money, I would be a ghost hunter.
Really? Okay. Yeah. If you had gotten on that train 15 years ago, you'd be a celebrity on television doing just that.
I'm confused by all of them. Because they're all the same show, and
the original. Okay, there's so many of them, but the the one I'm thinking of.
This is now Ghost Chat.
There was one
Sean and Mindy and Dean.
There's one where they made a point at the beginning of every episode, being like, "We're Roto-Rooter plumbers, but we're also ghost hunters."
I have missed that show.
My favorite, and I don't know if I've talked about it on the podcast, but my favorite is one that I can watch with my girlfriend because it is the closest to an HGTV ghost hunting show, where it is called Paranormal Home Inspectors.
Okay.
And it entirely takes place in Canada because that's where they can afford to make this show. And they have a team of researchers. They use a medium. And then as sort of like the closer, they have a contractor.
Uh-huh.
Who's actually very good, and it always comes up where, like, there were strange smells in the house, there were creaky noises, we had faucets turning on and off, and the guy looks around and he's like, you heard creepy noises from the attic and there was a smell. He looks up there, he's like, yeah, you've got raccoons in your attic. So that's not ghosts, that's wild animals.
Oh, so
from
he
the
disproves things.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
I like that. Like red lights.
And
I like that.
He really, like, just really soberly goes, you've got a cat. Cats love playing with faucets. It's turning on the water. Like, this isn't a big fucking mystery. It's my favorite thing to watch him debunk the worst psychic ever.
I'll have to watch that because that sounds really appealing. That's like the beginning of 1408.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would like to see these people's faces fall.
He's like, he debunks all of it.
I wouldn't be a debunker, though. I would be like a legit ghost chaser.
I think I would just get like phenomenally high. I would just get phenomenally high for every single episode. And then I would just legitimately like believe it. I would
There's an editorial note at the bottom of the screen. It's like, Mindy smoked crack before this went live. Did you guys, you hear that? Is that a cop car outside?
Well, you see Joe Rogan.
I smoke rocks.
This is amazing, Scully. You know what this could mean? It's almost too big to even comprehend.
This is the first time we get to see Scully in autopsy scene.
Oh
yeah, that too. That she was less wild about. She really thought it was
completely unnecessary.
Gratuitous.
Which it is. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But no, I was going to say the autopsy scene where she gets to be a doctor, and those are always my favorite elements. That, like, Mulder's got a theory for fucking everything. But at
she's
the end
just
of the
gonna
day,
cut it open and see.
Yeah, but I love that you know, that's the scientific approach. And
but can she? I don't know the rules here. But can you so quickly exhume a body and then cut it up immediately? Just because you're in the
like
FBI?
I feel like that's kind of bullshit. Like in real life there must be a waiting period. I can't imagine you can just find a body and then like immediately cut it open.
Yeah, and just because you're a doctor doesn't mean you can just do whatever you want. I feel.
I don't know.
Like maybe there's
about
a coroner that should do that. I don't know what coroners do actually.
Right. Well, maybe her degree isn't in pathology. Like, she doesn't specialize in autopsies, but
yeah, no, she's just a medical doctor.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't really, that doesn't mean, because even when they, later on in the show, when they go anytime into a hospital, she suddenly becomes a doctor that is apparently working at that hospital.
Right.
And well, they let her do whatever.
Oh, in the season 10 and the newest.
In the other ones too.
Here's what I really actually hope is actually happening. I hope that she has no clearance to do any of it. And she's just like, you know what? Fuck it.
I'm going to cut
this body open too. And no one's going to give me shit because I'm in the FBI.
Maybe that's why she's so mad at Mulder for taking pictures. She's like, don't take a picture because they can't prove.
Don't document this. I'm going to get sued. But even with all the, you know, bullshitty FBI stuff where it's not a real FBI, it's such a great show.
It's a great show. I love that show.
And I love this pilot. It really creeped me out as a young child. I mean, it's a really creepy plot. It's like people getting abducted and then like some of them are like waking comatose and Scully says vegetables. It was a different time, kids. But it's just, it works so well. And I think this was Chris Carter, like, at his peak. Because he has a journalism background. So it kind of shows in just the amount of exposition and the amount of documentation and all of the researching into things and all of the various steps they take to try to prove or disprove whether these kids have been abducted or not. I just think it works really well, and it was definitely a lightning in a bottle thing too, where it hit at exactly the right time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that it just exploded.
Yeah, I think
there was nothing like this.
I don't know if you try that nowadays.
Between Kolchak and like Twin Peaks, it seemed like the ground was set. They sort of they could guess that the American public had an interest enough in this.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, they just kind of took the ball and ran with it.
I built on so much that came before. The X-Files really capitalized on something that people were doing when I was a kid, which was horror and scare, with Night Gallery, Twilight Zone, Outer Limits. Those were shows that I loved and lived with as a kid. And The X-Files is the direct descendant of those shows. These other shows could, if they're a descendant of The X-Files, we are part of a longer lineage.
Yeah, no, I do love that the entire series, the template is here.
Yeah.
You've got Scully as the skeptical scientist who demands proof of any outlandish theories. And Mulder always has at least an educated guess. But it's funny, even, I guess, relatively early in this episode, he's kind of keeping the crazy under wraps. Like, he knows what it's going to sound like when he starts talking about aliens.
It's a slow build, and he's like, you can tell, he's like, when do I tell her it's aliens? And he's like, and then he waits. He's like, nah, not right now. I mean, later on, he just won't even hesitate. He'll just be like, it's werewolves, like in the first 2 seconds.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I think that's like with any relationship, you know, you should just like be cool at first. Right. And then you'd be like, by the way, I believe in ghosts. And you're like, damn it.
Yeah. And I'm an anti-vaxxer for why not? Let's just throw that on top of it. Let's just
surprise.
Also, this was back when they both wore their glasses.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. I didn't notice that. I was
their
thinking
round glasses.
That in their interview process, it was established even this early that Mulder doesn't take notes. And I think there's some amount of assumption that he's got like a photographic memory.
I assume so, yeah.
For details. But I don't know that it's ever really addressed that he doesn't write down what people are talking about. But he does seem to absorb it all.
He's like a really good waiter. You know, I'm always like amazed at that. Because I can't remember. If you told me something a minute ago, I probably won't remember it. A list of items? No way.
Like, one of my favorite lines in this episode is he's mentioning how there's a profile, and Scully just looks at him and goes, there's a profile for this? It's a really strong pilot, and you can see why the show took off, because, you know, you can make fun of it all you want, but there's definitely something with the X-Files that can't be taken away from it.
Yeah, and this is definitely one that, like, we make fun of it because we love it, because we've been through the ins and outs as many times and revisit. Jesus, Mindy watched the entire series. She's not kidding. Yeah. She watched the entire series right down.
I've watched it about twice now all the way through. And like, I've watched up to season 5, probably like 4 times.
Yeah, yeah. It's a huge undertaking. You know, it's because they're not all gems.
We were just looking on. So last night, after watching the pilot and taking notes, I jumped around a little bit, but I wound up at like episode 11 or 10 or 11 in this first season that I had never seen before. Somehow I had just passed over.
And I didn't remember this
bizarre, like Amish offshoot community that deals with the clay that makes people.
Is that Jewish guy or is that a different one?
This one is.
Is this just the guy that gender bender?
Gender bender. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, you remembered that.
Yeah. It was clever. I can
remember. No, I'm sorry.
No, if it's horror related, I can
Too
remember.
Too Shy was later on. That was the guy that that preyed on fat women because he wanted to eat their fat.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I don't remember. Well, Too Shy, he dated online.
Yeah.
That's that guy. Okay. Mm-hmm. Wow. That was early.
Gender bender is the first appearance of. The actor that plays Krychek,
he plays
really disturbed guy who was hoping to hook up.
Yeah, he goes home.
He's not hoping to hook up with a dude.
But I'm not supposed to believe that's Krychek, right?
No, I don't think we're expected to think it's Krychek. It does the thing that, like Law and Order does.
No, it's like, yeah, like Law and Order, where you're like, no, just don't. Just pretend like it's not the same actor.
Put a hat on him. He's a different guy. Like,
just give him a mustache.
A mustache and an eye patch. This character's really coming along, you guys.
And a hat.
I think we should write.
But yeah, that the episode ends with the cigarette smoking man going through the warehouse. I kind of love that moment. It's a little bit like not Last Crusade, Raiders of the Lost Ark style. And it's funny, I guess it does feed into a show like Warehouse 13 that's just like a collection of oddities and sort of off the books, creepy, magical, maybe alien remnants.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really like
that.
But
you gotta remember, at the time when that aired, it was like, it just, there was nothing like that on TV, and it exploded my little mind, because I was just like, holy shit, there's like a ton of those people getting abducted, enough that there's a whole warehouse.
Yeah, that to me was like, it was X-Files and Unsolved Mysteries, and it scared the shit out of me. That was my scary shows for the time.
The second episode, is the squeezy guy. Am I remembering that right?
Tombs, yeah. Eugene Tombs.
Yeah.
Okay, and that was a monster episode. So I love that, like, the show had momentum going forward.
Oh, yeah.
That, yeah, I don't know. I think I'm really partial to the monster.
The monster of the monster weeks of the are week. My thing. Yeah. You know, and I don't care about the black oil
I think
and stuff like
in
that.
In retrospect, when you watch all of the conspiracy stuff, like, it played really well when it was on air, but when it's back-to-back, it doesn't really work as well.
Yeah, it's because that
really
universe
tough,
is messed
though,
up.
It's really tough because, like, I'm such a diehard fan. I got a tattoo of the X, but then people, you know, talk about watching it on Netflix and being like, oh, it fucking sucks from, like, you know, the mythology. And I'm like, yeah, it doesn't hold up at all. But you got to understand, like, when it impacted me was when I was younger, when you couldn't watch them back to back, when you had to just ruminate on what you'd seen with the finale and you had to, like, your mind started filling in the gaps.
Mm-hmm.
So let's move on to Millennium.
Another Chris Carter production.
I gotta say, Millennium is like one of the most disturbing things I've ever seen in general, and I was shocked that that aired.
Yeah, Millennium was kind of... It shares a lot of elements with something like Hannibal in terms of a profiler, ultra-violence, but I mean, Hannibal really jumped it up a notch. Sean, do you have background on Millennium? Because I don't know why Chris Carter moved on from The X-Files.
I think he just wanted to do a show that was more serial killer based. And he wanted to deal with, you know, theories of the apocalypse occurring at the year 2000.
And I guess it was actually pretty ambitious that the show premiered in 1996. And the sort of unofficial finale was the X-Files crossover episode that happened in 1999?
I love that episode.
It's a good episode.
Love it.
Yeah. But so here, yes. So we have Lance Henriksen as Frank Black, right? Frank Black, the same name as the lead singer of the Pixies.
Yes, let's just pretend that's not a thing.
I don't know if one's to believe the IMDb trivia page, but apparently it was deliterate. But I don't know. It's,
honestly,
it's just it's
it
a
was
good.
Deliberate. I think Chris Carter was listening to the Pixies and he was like, Frank Black, that's a good name.
That sounds
he
great.
He was probably high off of his gourd, too.
So I mentioned before that this show, being composed of, with the exception of like his wife and kid, these are all people who've been doing these jobs for a long time. And Frank mm-hmm. Black, they sort of in exposition explain that he went overboard with the job and for a position where, not unlike Will Graham from Hannibal or Silence of the Lambs, well, I guess he wasn't in Silence, but in Red Dragon,
yeah.
To be so like ultra empathetic or empathic as to like inhabit the same mind space as a sociopathic killer, like taking that home with you is a mm-hmm. pretty grim concept.
What do you see?
I see what the killer sees.
What, like a psychic?
No. I put myself in his head. I become the thing we fear the most.
How?
I become capability. I become the horror. What we know we can become only in our heart of darkness. It's my gift. It's my curse. That's why I retired.
What the hell are you doing, Frank? Get out. Leave it alone.
I try.
I think what the pilot of Millennium establishes early on really well is the dichotomy between a guy who deals with primarily sex crimes, like mm-hmm. Sexually sadistic serial killers. But then he's got this sweet family, and he's just bought this brand new yellow house. And this is going to be, you know, his new life in this nice yellow house and this nice neighborhood in Seattle. And he's going to try to kind of push the other stuff aside and maybe try to like compartmentalize a little more, or not take it home with him so he can do this. And I think ultimately what the pilot does really well is it shows that there's no way to escape taking that kind of work home with you, mm-hmm. and that ultimately it's just terribly tragic because here's this guy that just wants to live his life and doesn't want to like tell his wife what he has to see, or like doesn't want his daughter to grow up in the world that he knows exists with these type of people because he's been researching them and getting into their minds even.
Yeah.
So it's really heartbreaking too if you think about it.
Yeah, I just have looping in my head the Nietzsche quote about looking into the void and the void looking into you, and he who battles monsters should be careful that he himself does not also become a monster. It's like almost the mantra for the show in terms of taking your work home with you.
Definitely.
Yeah. But it's also like the most 90s-ish thing you will see. Hey, Pig. It starts, well, just in terms of like the soundtrack at the beginning.
Oh, the pilot itself. Yeah.
It's like, yeah, the pilot itself, it's like Rob Zombie. And then it's like immediately into a Nine Inch Nails song. And it's like set in Seattle and like,
yeah,
you know, Frank Black is our protagonist.
And it really is heavy-handed. Just, I mean, there isn't a peep show or strip club in the world that would use Nine Inch Nails' Hey Pig as like the sexy dancing song. It's a weird
move. Well, maybe, because the girls get to choose their own songs. You know, like
they're
a lot
really
of times.
They're really depressed girls, yeah.
No, but I think like there could be like a goth strip, or you don't know.
Well, she's not on camera ever, but yeah, I don't know. And none of those strippers...
She's crying in the corner.
I guess that is the very first shot, right?
It's very sexy before it cuts to the opening sequence.
That opening scene in the like nudie booths, which has that for a relic of like,
and I had only ever seen
shows.
That in like Boondock Saints, the idea of the screens going up and down. So yeah. I was like, oh, okay.
They were here in New York right up to the 90s before Giuliani restricted, you know, how things could be sold and whatnot. But I was surprised that each window had its own woman. That is not cost effective. That is,
well, that's the private. In the general room, though, with all the windows, there was like three or four women.
But that's still more women than, like, my understanding of the way it used to be is like one woman and a round of windows.
I mean, you got to remember this is Seattle, too, so they might have done things a little differently.
Maybe. Yeah, that's true. Fair. That's true.
Yeah. Starting on the point before regarding, like, the way TV shows are usually casted these days, it's kind of like who's hot and sexy, and how do you explain someone with no, like, no wrinkles on their face.
Lance Henriksen, yeah.
Yeah, how do you explain that?
I adore him, although he is substantially older than his wife.
It's a very wrinkly old man, and he researches into sex crimes.
It's like, how much did you guys love Pumpkinhead? Well, that's going to be that guy all the time. But yeah, no, I love that every character in this, especially those in the Millennium group, are like practically old men.
Mm-hmm.
And in every other show, like, they have to go the really bizarre, unrealistic route of turning every young person into like a Doogie Howser who is just like uber intelligent, who's not dissimilar to like Scully, who's got a MD.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, this is a world that's like been lived in, and Frank is clearly still recovering from mental trauma. But
he's also the guy that knows more than these other detectives. He's just more intelligent.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't think of this in terms of like a show like Monk, but like, I don't know, the detective, well, I guess he's not even, he's Sherlock. He's like a consulting detective or whatever.
He's a profiler.
Tell me what you want. Do you like me?
But yeah, so we mentioned the show starts with the sort of nudie booth, strip club kind of setting. And they refer to this guy as the Frenchman, right?
Yes, the Frenchman, because he's putting up French poetry.
I gotta give it to this actor, so too, the guy that plays the Frenchman. I think pound for pound, and I've watched a lot of movies, seen a lot of shows, he is probably one of the creepiest dudes I've ever seen.
In this first episode, do we meet Terry Quinn or
really
O'Quinn?
Briefly, he's outside of Frank's house at one point, and he's like, hey, man, I got some information for you. And then his wife's like, why is there somebody hanging outside our house?
I'm Peter Watts from the group. I would have faxed you, but I want to introduce myself.
I heard you were down looking at the body. Did you find anything?
A few things slipped by. One salient oversight.
Frank?
I'll be right in, Catherine.
There was severe blunt trauma to the body, so it was easy to miss. But inside the victim's left thigh, I found a needle puncture.
From what, a syringe?
Maybe. There was no evidence of anything administered in the adipose and surrounding tissue. I know they think the killer's black male.
I've already ruled that out.
The disseverance of the head and the fingers was done with skill, precision. You know why?
The killer was covering his tracks. The victim may have scratched or bitten him. He may not have gone down there to kill her.
Kitchen knife was convenient, but he knew what he was doing. And with real sang-froid, judging by his tidy cleanup.
What does the group think?
That your instincts were right. The killer's being compelled by an extraneous stressor. He's out of control.
Anything else?
That you're the right man for this. All our resources will be available to you.
You know, from when you're in the strip club, it has this devastatingly disturbing scene where you finally see the Frenchman. He's saying this creepy shit like, I will watch you dance on the blood-rimmed tide, while he's getting this private show.
But the ceremony of innocence is drowned.
I know you like it. Don't be shy.
This is the second death. The abominable. And the fornicators. This is the second death.
Tell me what you want.
And it cuts to his POV, and you see that there's like blood leaking down this stripper, and there's like flames in the background. He just keeps like, you're not sure what he's quoting. It might be the Bible. I mean, I'm not a historian.
He's prophesizing
the end of the world,
the great plague in the maritime city, Le Grand Pest in the Cité Maritime. Pest, the word written on the lid of the buried coffin. It's from Nostradamus, the 16th century apocalyptic poet.
So you think the killer is fulfilling the prophecy?
The great plague in the maritime city will not stop until death is avenged by the blood of a just man. The great lady is outraged by the pretense. Seattle, the maritime city, AIDS, the great plague. Death avenged by a just man, taken and condemned for no crime.
So the killer thinks he's righteous, a just man.
Who's the great lady? And why is she outraged?
The killer is confused about his sexuality. He feels guilt. Quite possibly from his mother. So he goes to peep shows to try to feel something toward women, but all he feels is anger. Anger that fuels a psychosis that distorts and twists his view of reality.
He's just saying like the creepiest shit, and it's like his eyes are kind of hidden by shadow, and he's just like seeing this woman like covered in blood and dancing in flames. And then it cuts to the credits, or the opening titles. And you're just like, what the fuck? Like, I can't imagine
watching that for the first time.
Even on the X-Files.
Yeah. On network television, this probably aired at 9 o'clock.
Yeah, because it's like so sexy. And then you cut to the titles. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah. I did love when they start analyzing, he sort of, he can zoom in pretty amazingly to
enhance
the tiny piece of paper.
Enhance.
And so he essentially gets out the entire poem, and I think it was even he had to translate it from French. Like, he's resourceful. But then he started figuring out, like, this is from Blake. This is from the Bible. Like, this is from Revelations, etc. And I loved. I love this sort of immaculate corpse version of, like, the creepiest poetry ever.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually harkens back to the idea that the X-Files had, like, committed researchers working on this stuff. That,
right.
I love those moments where the story is really driven home by the details.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, Sean, I was going to ask you that this relates to serial killers. And that is sort of research specific with the work that you've done on the short story collection. Murder is a recurring theme.
It is. I'm glad you noticed.
Do you get into the research side of things, or is it more imagination?
Nowadays it's imagination, but I have to admit that I spent 2 years working on a first novel that will probably never see the light of day, because as the nature of a lot of first things, it's not that great. But I did a lot of research into serial killers, so I have that knowledge in my brain, and it's not going away. Trust me. But I think that informed a lot of my earlier work. You also have to understand that Too Late is a lot. Some of those stories are 8 years old. Those are a lot of early work. They go back. I think the most recent story in that is still probably 5 years old.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Yeah, I remember. I think I read Stranded in the Storm on your website probably.
Yeah.
But I had read it once before. I really like the sort of setting and the calmness of this setting. Meanwhile, horrible things are happening. Like, there's just, and you're in Massachusetts, like, you're no stranger to snow, that it is.
I think it was a combination of a couple things that actually occurred in my life. There was one point where I was driving on a very specific stretch of road, and it was raining pretty hard, and we got a flat tire, and it was me and some friends. So we pulled over. And we're like trying to change the tire. And as we have the car jacked up, the car just kind of like, because it's so muddy, it starts to go and then it smashes down. And eventually, okay, so we get the tire on. So there's that memory in there. And then there was another time I was just driving the same stretch of road, and it was really icy and really snowy. And it was this long curving road that's in Lincoln, Massachusetts. And I just thought to myself, like, what would happen if I, like, skidded out and just fell into that field? I don't think I'd ever be able to, like, back up into traffic or into the street, especially considering it's so icy right now. And so that kind of laid the groundwork. And then I thought, well, what would be, like, a terrible thing to happen if you were stuck in the middle of nowhere on, like, icy, slick roads and you're waiting for AAA to come? And I thought, like, well, what if an animal attacked you? Like, you'd be kind of screwed. I mean, you could wait in the car. Well, what if it was an animal that could break into the car? And there we go.
And you guys just had on Miskatonic Music, I forget the author's name, but his book was one of werewolves. And you kind of talked
Jones,
about
it. He wrote a fabulous book called Mongrels, which is about werewolves.
The conversation was really fascinating in terms of the logistics of, I mean, this sort of allegory going back to, like, one of puberty, and if that is, like, a changing point in someone's life, then what happens at, like, menopause? And, like, all these questions that it doesn't occur to anyone to consider in terms of lore.
Well, the genius of Stephen Graham Jones is he is the man that considers those things.
Yeah.
Like, the stuff that most people are like, oh, I don't care what a vampire would do if he got bitten by a zombie. Like, Stephen actually... I feel like every one of those scenarios, he has sat down at one point and been like, okay, what would happen? I think in general, what I took from Millennium from that pilot was some of the imagery is just terrifying. In particular, the image of, you know, going through the woods at night and you're hearing screaming under the ground.
Yeah. So
you dig under the ground and there's a guy and his eyes are sewn shut and his mouth is sewn shut.
Yeah.
And there's a decapitated head in a bag in the same coffin with him. And that, I think that more than any other image was what really stuck with me. It was like, holy fuck. And also, I just saw that on TV.
On Fox.
That's true. Yeah.
Even the X-Files gets pretty gory at times. I was just thinking that Tales from the Crypt is the only one of these that was on cable.
Mm-hmm.
But there's not a lot of difference in content.
We're both on Fox, yeah.
Yeah. And like the censorship line isn't really noticeable in any of these shows.
You know, Fox in the old days was a completely different channel,
You
know, because when you first saw even like The Simpsons or the Gary Shandling show, things like that, it was very different. Tracy Ullman's show was very
All in the Family, the
channel.
Whole point, not All in the Family, what am I thinking? Married with Children. The point was to like piss people off and make people uncomfortable.
It was a very different channel that you kind of expected kind of the weirder stuff used to be on Fox.
Yeah. So we'll start heading to the close. So the collection is called Too Late?
Yes.
Too Late, yes, because I'm getting up there in age, so who knows how long I'll be around.
Old balls walking over here.
Did you just...
Yes, she did.
Yes,
she
I did.
You're not old.
No, I'm only 30.
You're younger than I am.
It's fine.
Yeah, you're younger than Darren.
Okay, so the collection, by the time this comes out, there's Throwing Down the Gauntlet. It should be available on Amazon for the Kindle and plans for print release.
Yes, I would like to emphasize it really should be out by now. That's not to say that it is, but it should be.
And where can people find you online, Sean?
Facebook.com/SpookySean, @SpookySeanT. And, of course, my website is SpookySean.com, where I will be posting about Too Late. I would also like to plug that on a website called The Conqueror Weird, I have a 12-part serialized story entitled The Demon, and the second part will be coming out in August, on August the 13th. We're going to be releasing all of the parts on the 13th of the month.
Cool.
Oh, I'm also on Miskatonic Musings.
Yeah.
Yes, of course. That's how we know you. You and Charles and now Lehman are Miskatonic Musings. Really funny podcast that we obviously endorse.
Yeah.
We are The Rance Macabre. We are on social media at Rance Macabre on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. The website is The Rance Macabre. Find us on Patreon. We need some help sort of keeping the ship afloat.
Yes.
What else? That's it.
I think that's the thing.
Email is therancemacabre@gmail.com.
Yeah.
But yeah, thanks. Thanks for joining us, Sean.
Anytime. Yeah. And anytime you want to hop back on Miskatonic Musings, we'd be glad to have you.
Cool.
You've been listening to The Rance Macabre, a presentation of the Fangoria Podcast Network. Produced by Darren Rosario and Thomas DeFeo, and executive produced by Ken Hanley of Fangoria Entertainment. For press opportunities, advertising inquiries, and information about The Rance Macabre, contact Ken at Fangoria.com.
This is Darren signing off.
And this is Mindy.
And I am Sean.
And that's Murphy. Perfect.